You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The war in Syria is in its sixth year, and as a war, it has been plagued by the spread of propaganda, misinformation, and competing narratives as the parties involved attempt to control the information war taking place adjacent to the conflict on the ground. This has been made apparent in the last week alone with the media's coverage of the chemical weapons attack that was carried out against Syrian civilians. But how exactly does the media cover conflict? What barriers do they face? And who should we believe when there are so many different versions of events? Well, earlier I spoke to Auckland University political studies lecturer and expert in media and conflict, Dr. Maria Amudian, and I began by asking what the media's role is during war and conflict.
I think the role of media in conflict, but also outside of conflict, is generally that we've got to give people information about what is going on so that people understand what is happening in their names by their governments or by other groups. People need to know a lot of things. For one, are there atrocities being committed under their names? And another thing is, of course, are certain regions unsafe to travel to? So there are a whole host of things that people need to know, and it's particularly true in democracy more than anything else, because people get to say whether or not they want to keep their leaders in office. How are they spending their money? Are they spending them on ethical, good, moral, sound judgment, humanitarian aid, or are they spending their money on things that generally we would not approve of? So this is just kind of a general idea of a journalist's role. It's particularly difficult in conflict, and that's because, as one award-winning journalist who went on to become a journalism professor in Los Angeles, Michael Parks, has often said, the guys with the guns make the rules, and journalists have to follow the rules in which they must report under. And so that means there are certain constraints. Doesn't mean they follow them completely to the T, but it means that there are constraints that make it very difficult for journalists to get into conflict zones or other types of areas in order to get that information to the public.
How much influence then do the parties involved in conflict have in controlling the narrative and what gets told?
Well, it's a little bit of a sort of a struggle between journalists and the parties of the conflict. So journalists want to find out what's happening. A good journalist, a good, ethical, responsible journalist wants to get to the truth of the matter, the heart of the matter, what's really going on here. And so when you think about what they have to go through, which is often quite, you know, difficult and complicated, but a lot of times they have to get pre-screened. Sometimes they get censored. Sometimes they get punished. And these are all things that they consider before they enter a conflict zone. Often they have to have some kind of pass to get into a conflict zone too. Well, who do you think gives those passes? Sometimes it's a government, right? And so you may not even be able to get in if the government doesn't want you in. But sometimes it's a rebel group. So there were cases, for example, I interviewed a bunch of journalists for my past book, some cases where journalists were having to get passes from these rebel groups, much like ISIS. And so in order to get through, you have to be able to make a case. Well, what is that case that you're making? What's the story you're going to tell? And are you going to be able to survive to tell that story? Of course, there's a third way that people get into conflict zones, the third primary way, and that's by embedding with the military. And that's sometimes a government military, but sometimes it's a rebel military. And in both of those cases, you see essentially what the rebel group or the government military is seeing. You don't necessarily see what's outside of that. They are protecting you. Journalists are now protected by those military forces, and so there is a relationship that builds that might start to color the reporting that comes out. One more thing, the final way that sometimes journalists do go into these zones is by sneaking in, getting smuggled in, bribing their way in, fake IDs, and some actually do this and come out with really important stories.
Why is it then that so much misinformation and propaganda gets spread during conflicts?
Because it's very hard to cover. First of all, you're asking a journalist to risk his or her life, to go into a conflict zone like Syria. And, you know, you've seen that how many journalists have been killed in Syria. I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but they're really big numbers. And some of these journalists who are, you know, tried and true, have covered conflict after conflict after conflict, know their stuff, know how to travel, know how to report this material, and are still getting killed. So Marie Colvin is one of these examples. She had been reporting on conflict for a very long time. She'd been injured before. She went to Syria. She was staying in a particular area where a lot of journalists were staying, and the Syrian government shelled it. And so she's dead. And this, you know, so this is one reason why propaganda is such an easy thing to do, because you don't have third parties able to go in there, cover the material, and come out with uncensored, unpunished information.
Who should we believe then when it's so difficult to tell what is real and what is fake?
Oh, that is one of the hardest questions of all, even for scholars. So, it's almost like if you become a specialist in a region, and there are people who are specialists in regions, like in Syria, for example, who can study the information that they're getting from multiple sources and parse it out. And through that, you can start to understand the reality of it. But every side in a conflict has a lot at stake, and they view it from their own biases. And so when you hear their side of the story, it's not a complete picture. And this is true even of witnessing things. And so somebody has to be able to hear from multiple points of view and from a historical perspective to be able to put the final information together. It's very hard in a situation like Syria to get that.
Has the advent of social media made it more difficult to get fairer accounts of what is happening in conflicts such as Syria?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, maybe no. I mean, I think there are organizations that are now coming up to take material from some social media, like video, and checking to see if it could be authentic. Because sometimes these, even this video, can be tampered with, doctored, and you don't know if it's really true. But these organizations are going through them, you know, piece by piece, and analyzing, well, you know, could that person have actually fallen that way? Is that building really there next to that mountain? You know, and so they're really analyzing this to see if it's if the video has been doctored. But the problem with social media is, of course, anybody can say anything. It doesn't go through fact-checking, as traditional media had for many, many years, and still does as good of a job as it can. But it's also made things go faster. And so even traditional journalism outlets can't always go through the traditional fact-checking process. And look, even when they do, they often get it wrong. The New York Times was so wrong with Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. So it's extraordinarily difficult. It's the most difficult time to get information, and particularly unbiased information, because lives are at stake, territory is at stake, water is at stake. You know, these are the major points of life.
Does the media have an obligation to get involved to try and resolve conflicts?
No, I don't think so. I think the media's job generally, when we're talking particularly about the news media, is to really, the responsible, ethical thing to do is to try to give context, to give a fair account, so that people can try to understand what's happening, and to not just focus on the he said, she said, the blame game, the hate frames, or to take sides. Mm-hmm. People need to understand these things thoroughly.
Why then is it that some conflicts get so much coverage while others, mostly African conflicts, for example, get little to no coverage?
I think that what happens in this is, you're speaking particularly about New Zealand, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily Africa covers African conflicts. So I think part of what drives journalism in particular is what our elected or appointed or dictator positions think are important. And so when the United States is involved in a conflict, the U.S. journalists think it's their obligation to cover it. So they go where the United States leadership goes. And so then New Zealand, of course, being connected to, you know, the big conflicts that the United States is involved with, then, of course, also covers it. So Western journalism follows Western government leadership, and that's why we get it the way we do.
Just finally then, is reporting on conflict in a better state now or a worse state?
I think it's in a worse state. I think before, journalists' lives were not as expendable as they have become. In the past, when traditional journalism was the only way for rebel groups particularly to get their stories out, they would not behead a journalist. They would want to tell their story. Now with social media, they can tell their story and they can tell it to their audiences, and they don't need traditional journalists the way they used to. And so they want to keep their frames the way they want to tell it, and they don't want their sins exposed. And so they make it more dangerous for a traditional journalist to report.
They are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.